chariot down a forest path, lashing the flanks of the twin white billy goats with a whip when they flagged. She had observed the small cooking fire burning beside the path from almost half a mile back, and she knew from the colour of the flames that it was the fire of one of her people, for witch fires burn with certain unusual hues. So she reined in her goats when she reached the brightly painted gypsy caravan and the cooking fire, and the iron-haired old woman who sat beside the fire tending to the spit over the flames on which a hare was roasting. Fat dripped from the hare's open gut, hissing and sizzling in the fire which gave off the twin aromas of cooking meat and of wood smoke. A multicolored bird sat by the driver's seat at the front of the caravan on a wooden perch. It raised its feathers and called out in alarm when it saw the witch queen, but it was chained to its perch and could not leave.
"Before you says anything," said the grey-haired woman, "I should tell ye that I'm just a poor old flower-seller, a harmless old biddy who's never done nothing to no one, and that the sight of a grand and terrifying lady such as yourself fills me with dread and fear."
"I will not harm you," said the witch-queen. The harridan screwed her eyes to slits and looked the lady in the red kirtle up and down.
"That's what you says," she said. "But how am I to know that it's so, a sweet old dear like me, who's all a-tremble from her toes to her water? You might be planning to rob me in the night, or worse."
And she poked the fire with a stick, so it leapt up. The smell of the cooked meat hung on the still evening air. "I swear," said the lady in the scarlet kirtle, "that by the rules and constraints of the sisterhood to which you and I belong, by the puissance of the lilim, and by my lips and breasts and maidenhood, that I mean you no harm, and shall treat you as if you were my own guest."
"That's good enough for me, dearie ducks," said the old woman, her face breaking into a smile. "Come and sit down. Supper'll be cooked in two shakes of a lamb's tail."
"With good will," said the lady in the red kirtle. The goats snuffled and munched at the grass and the leaves beside the chariot, eyeing with distaste the tethered mules that pulled the caravan.
"Fine goats," said the harridan.
The witch queen inclined her head and smiled modestly. The firelight glinted on the little scarlet snake wrapped as a bracelet about her wrist. The harridan went on.
"Now, my dear, my old eyes aren't what once they were by any means, but would I be correct in supposing that one of those fine fellows started life walking on two legs, not four?"
"Such things have been heard of," admitted the witch queen. "That splendid bird of yours, for example."
"That bird gave away one of the prizes of my stock of items for sale. Gave it away to a good-for-nothing nearly 20 years ago. And afterward the trouble she put me through scarcely bears considering. So these days she stays a bird, unless there's work that needs doing, or the flower store to run. And if I could find a good, strong servant not afraid of a little hard work, why, then she would stay a bird forever."
The bird chirruped sadly upon her perch.
"They call me Mistress Semele," said the harridan.
"They called you Ditchwater Sal when you were a young chit of a thing," thought the witch queen, but she did not say this aloud.
"You may call me Morwaneg," said the witch instead.
It was, she reflected, almost a joke, for Morwaneg means wave of the sea, and her true name was long since drowned and lost beneath the cold ocean. Mistress Semele got to her feet and made her way into the interior of the caravan, emerging with two painted wooden bowls, two wooden-handled knives, and a small pot of herbs, dried and flaked to a green powder.
"I was going to be eating with fingers on a plate of fresh leaves," she said, handing a bowl to the lady in the scarlet kirtle.
The bowl had a sunflower painted upon it, under a layer of dust.
"But I thought, well, how often does I get such fine company? So nothing but the best. Heads or tails?"
"Let it be your choice," said her guest.
"Head, then, for you, with the luscious eyes and brains and the crispy, crunchy ears of him. And I'll have the rump, with nothing but dull meat to nibble."
She lifted the spit off the fire as she spoke, and using both knives so fast they seemed little more than a glitter of blades, she parted the carcass and sliced the meat from the bones and dealt it out, fairly equitably, into each bowl. She passed the pot of herbs to her guest.
"There's no salt, my dear, but if you shake this on, it'll do the trick. A little basil, a little mountain thyme, my own recipe.
The witch queen took her portion of roasted hare and one of the knives and sprinkled a little of the herbs onto the dish. She speared a bite on the point of the knife and ate it with relish, while her hostess toyed with her own portion, then blew on it fastidiously, steam coming from the crisp brown meat.
"How is it?" asked the old woman.
"Perfectly palatable," said her guest, honestly.
"It is the herbs make it so fine," explained the harridan.
"I can taste the basil and the thyme," said the guest, "but there is another taste I find harder to place."
"Ah," said Madame Semele, and she nibbled a sliver of the meat.
"It is certainly a most uncommon taste."
"That it is. It's a herb that grows only in Garamond, on an island in the midst of a wide lake. It is most pleasant with all manner of meats and fishes, and it reminds me in flavour a little of the leaves of fennel, with but a hint of nutmeg. The flowers of it are a most attractive shade of orange. It is good for wind and the ague, and it is, in addition, a gentle soporific, which has the curious property of causing one who tastes of it to speak nothing but the truth for several hours."
The lady in the scarlet kirtle dropped her wooden bowl onto the ground.
"Limbus grass," she said.
"You dared to feed me limbus grass?"
"That's how it would seem, dearie."
And the old woman cackled and hooted with delight.
"So tell me now, Mistress Morwenneg, if that's your name, where are you a-going of in your fine chariot, and why do you remind me so of someone I knew once? And Madame Semele forgets nothing and no one."
"I am on my way to find a star," said the witch queen, "which fell in the great woods on the other side of Mount Belly. And when I find her, I shall take my great knife and cut out her heart while she lives, and while her heart is her own. For the heart of a living star is a sovereign remedy against all the snares of age and time. My sisters wait for me to return."
Madame Semele hooted and hugged herself, swaying back and forth, bony fingers clutching her sides. "The heart of a star, is it? Such a prize it will make for me. I shall taste enough of it that my youth will come back, and my hair turn from grey to golden, and my dugs swell and soften and become firm and high. Then I shall take all the heart that's left to the great market at Wall."
"You shall not do this thing," said her guest, very quietly.
"No, you are my guest, my dear. You swore your oath. You've tasted of my food. According to the laws of our sisterhood, there is nothing you can do to harm me."
"Oh, there are so many things I could do to harm you, Ditchwater Sal. But I shall simply point out that one who has eaten limbus grass can speak nothing but the truth for several hours afterward. And one more thing." Distant lightning flickered in her words as she spoke, and the forest was hushed, as if every leaf and every tree were listening intently to what she said. "This I say. You have stolen knowledge that you did not earn, but it shall not profit you. For you shall be unable to see the star, unable to perceive it, unable to touch it, to taste it, to find it, to kill it. Even if another were to cut out its heart and give it to you, you would not know it, never know what you had in your hand. This I say. These are my words, and they are a true speaking. And know this also. I swore, by the compact of the sisterhood, that I would do you no harm. Had I not so sworn, I would change you into a black beetle, and I would pull your legs off one by one, and leave you for the birds to find, for putting me to this indignity." Madame Semele's eyes opened wide with fright, and she stared over the flames of the fire at her guest. "Who are you?" she said. "When you knew me last," said the woman in the scarlet kirtle, "I ruled with my sisters in Carnadine before it was lost."
"You? But you were dead, long dead."
"They have said that the Lilim were dead before now, but they have always lied. The squirrel has not yet found the acorn that will grow into the oak that will be cut to form the cradle of the babe who will grow to slay me. Silver flashes glittered and flared in the flames as she spoke.
"So it is you, and you have your youth back," Madame Semele sighed. "And now I, too, shall be young again."
The lady in the scarlet kirtle stood up then and placed the bowl which had contained her portion of hair into the fire.
"You shall be nothing of the kind," she said. "Did you not hear me? A moment after I leave, you shall forget that you ever saw me. You shall forget all of this, even my curse, although the knowledge of it shall vex and irritate you, like an itch in a limb long since amputated. And may you treat your guests with more grace and respect in the future."
The wooden bowl burst into flames then, a huge gout of flame which singed the leaves of the oak tree far above them. Madame Semele knocked the blackened bowl from the fire with a stick, and she stamped it out in the long grass.
"Whatever could have possessed me to drop the bowl into the fire?" she exclaimed aloud. "And look, one of my nice knives all burned up and ruined. Whatever was I thinking of?"
There came no answer. From further down the road came the drumming beats of something that might have been the hooves of goats racing on into the night. Madame Semele shook her head as if to clear it of dust and cobwebs.
"I'm getting old,"
she said to the multicoloured bird who sat on its perch by the driver's seat and who had observed everything and forgotten nothing.
"Getting old, and there's no doing anything about that."
The bird shifted uncomfortably on the perch. A red squirrel quested, hesitating a little, into the firelight. It picked up an acorn, held it for a moment in its hand-like front paws, as if it were praying. Then it ran away, to bury the acorn, and to forget it.
Skaith's Ebb is a small seaport town built on granite, a town of chandlers and carpenters and sailmakers, of old sailors with missing fingers and limbs who've opened their own grog-houses, or spend their days in them. What is left of their hair still tarred into long queues, though the stubble on their chins has long since dusted to white. There are no whores in Skaith's Ebb, or none that consider themselves as such, although there have always been many women who, if pressed, would describe themselves as much married, with one husband on this ship here every 6 months, and another husband on that ship back in port for a month or so every 9 months. The mathematics of the thing have always kept most folk satisfied, and if ever it disappoints and a man returns to his wife while one of her other husbands is still in occupancy, why, then there's a fight, and the grog shops to comfort the loser. The sailors do not mind the arrangement, for they know that this way there will, at the least, be one person who, at the last, will notice when they do not come back from the sea, and will mourn their loss. And their wives content themselves with the certain knowledge that their husbands are also unfaithful, for there is no competing with the sea in a man's affections, since she is both mother and mistress, and she will wash his corpse also in time to come, wash it to coral and ivory and pearls. So it was to Skaith's Ebb that Lord Primus of Stormhold came one night, all dressed in black, with a beard as thick and serious as one of the stork's nests in the town's chimneys. He came in a carriage drawn by 4 black horses, and he took a room in the Seaman's Rest on Crook Street. He was considered most peculiar in his needs and requests, for he brought his own food and drink into his rooms, and kept it locked in a wooden chest, which he would only open to take himself an apple, or a wedge of cheese, or a cup of pepper wine. His was the topmost room in the Seaman's Rest, a high and spindly building built on a rocky outcrop to facilitate smuggling. He bribed a number of the local street urchins to report to him the moment they saw any fellow they did not know come to town, by land or sea. In particular, they were to look for a very tall, angular, dark-haired fellow with a thin, hungry face and blank eyes.
"Primus is certainly learning caution," said Secundus to his 4 other dead brothers. "Well, you know what they say," whispered Quintus, in the wistful tones of the dead which sounded, on that day, like the lapping of distant waves upon the shingle. "A man who is tired of looking over his shoulder for Septimus is tired of life."
In the mornings, Primus would talk to the sea captains with ships in Skaith's Ebb, buying them grog liberally, but neither drinking nor eating with them. In the afternoon, he would inspect the ships in the docks. Soon, the gossips of Skaith's Ebb, and there were many, had the gist and juice of it all. The bearded gentleman was to be taking ship to the east. And this tale was soon chased by another, that he would be sailing out on the heart of a dream under Captain Yan, a black-trimmed ship with its decks painted crimson-red, of more or less savoury reputation, by which I mean that it was generally held that she kept her piracies for distant waters. And this would be happening as soon as he gave the word.
"Good master," said a street urchin to Lord Primus. "There's a man in town come by land. He lodges with Mistress Petia. He's thin and crow-like, and I saw him in the ocean's roar, buying grog for every man in the room. He says he's a distressed seafaring man, seeking a berth."
Primus patted the boy's filthy head and handed him a coin. Then he returned to his preparations, and that afternoon it was announced that the Heart of a Dream would leave harbour in 3 short days. The day before the Heart of a Dream was to set sail, Primus was seen to sell his coach and 4 horses to the stableman on Wardle Street, after which he walked down to the quay, dispensing small coins to the urchins. He entered his cabin in the Heart of a Dream and gave strict orders that none was to disturb him for any reason, good or bad, until they were at least a week out of port. That evening, an unfortunate accident befell an able seaman who had crewed the rigging on the Heart of a Dream. He fell, when drunk, on the slippery cobblestones of Revenue Street and broke his hip. Luckily, there was a replacement at the ready, the very sailor with whom he had been drinking that evening and to whom the injured man had been persuaded to demonstrate a particularly complicated hornpipe step on the wet cobbles. And this sailor, tall, dark, and crow-like, marked his ship's papers with a circle that night and was on deck at dawn when the ship sailed out of the harbour in the morning mist. The Heart of a Dream sailed east. Lord Primus of Stormhold, his beard freshly shaven, watched it sail from the cliff-top until it was lost to view. Then he walked down to Wardle Street, where he returned the stableman's money and something more besides, and he rode off on the coast road toward the west in a dark coach pulled by 4 black horses. It was an obvious solution. After all, the unicorn had been ambling hugely behind them for most of the morning, occasionally nudging the star's shoulder with its big forehead. The wounds on its dappled flanks, which had blossomed like red flowers under the lion's claws the day before, were now dried to brown and scabbed over. The star limped and hobbled and stumbled, and Tristram walked beside her, cold chain binding wrist to wrist. On the one hand, Tristram felt there was something almost sacrilegious about the idea of riding the unicorn. It was not a horse, did not subscribe to any of the ancient pacts between man and horse. There was a wildness in its black eyes and a twisting spring to its step, which was dangerous and untamed. On the other hand, Tristram had begun to feel, in a way that he could not articulate, that the unicorn cared about the star and wished to help her. So he said, "Look, I know all that stuff about frustrating my plans every step of the way, but if the unicorn is willing, perhaps it would carry you on its back for a little way." The star said nothing. "Well," she shrugged. Tristram turned to the unicorn, stared into its pool-black eyes. "Can you understand me?" he asked. It said nothing. He'd hoped it would nod its head or stamp a hoof, like the trained horse he had once seen on the village green when he was younger, but it simply stared. "Will you carry the lady, please?" The beast said not a word, nor did it nod or stamp, but it walked to the star and it knelt down at her feet. Tristram helped the star onto the unicorn's back. She grasped its tangled mane with both hands and sat side-saddle upon it, her broken leg sticking out, and that was how they travelled for some hours. Tristram walked along beside them, carrying her crutch over his shoulder, with his bag dangling from the end. He found it as hard to travel with the star riding the unicorn as it had been before. Then he'd been forced to walk slowly, trying to keep pace with the star's limping hobble. Now he was hurrying to keep up with the unicorn, nervous lest the unicorn should get too far ahead and the chain that linked them both should pull the star from the beast's back. His stomach rumbled as he walked. He was painfully aware how hungry he was. Soon Tristram began to think of himself as nothing more than hunger, thinly surrounded by flesh, and, as fast as he could, walking, walking. He stumbled and knew that he was going to fall.
"Please stop!" he gasped.
The unicorn slowed and stopped. The star looked down at him. Then she made a face and shook her head.
"You had better come up here too," she said, "if the unicorn will let you. Otherwise you'll just faint or something and drag me onto the ground with you. And we need to go somewhere so that you can get food."
Tristram nodded gratefully. The unicorn appeared to offer no opposition, waiting passively, so Tristram attempted to clamber up onto it. It was like climbing a sheer wall, and as fruitless. Eventually, Tristram led the animal over to a beech tree that had been uprooted several years before by a storm or a high wind or an irritable giant. And holding his bag and the star's crutch, he scrambled up the roots onto the trunk and from there onto the back of the unicorn.
"There's a village on the other side of that hill," said Tristram. "I expect that we can find something to eat when we get there."
He patted the unicorn's flanks with his free hand. The beast began to walk. Tristram moved his hand to the star's waist to steady himself. He could feel the silken texture of her thin dress, and beneath that, the thick chain of the topaz about her waist. Riding a unicorn was not like riding a horse. It did not move like a horse. It was a wilder ride, and a stranger one. The unicorn waited until Tristram and the star were comfortable upon its back, and then, slowly and easily, it began to put on speed. The trees surged and leapt past them. The star leaned forward, her fingers tangled into the unicorn's mane. Tristram, his hunger forgotten in his fear, gripped the sides of the unicorn with his knees and simply prayed that he would not be knocked to the ground by a stray branch. Soon he found he was beginning to enjoy the experience. There's something about riding a unicorn, for those people who still can, which is unlike any other experience. Exhilarating and intoxicating and fine. The sun was setting when they reached the outskirts of the village. In a rolling meadow beneath an oak tree, the unicorn came to a skittish halt and would go no further. Tristram dismounted and landed with a bump on the grass of the meadow. His rump felt sore, but with the star looking down at him, uncomplaining, he dared not rub it.
"Are you hungry?"
he asked the star. She said nothing.
"Look," he said, "I'm starving. Perfectly famished. I don't know if stars eat or what they eat, but I won't have you starving yourself."
He looked up at her, questioning. She stared down at him, first impassively, then in a trice her blue eyes filled with tears. She raised a hand to her face and wiped away the tears, leaving a smudge of mud on her cheeks.
"We eat only darkness," she said, "and we drink only light, so I'm not hungry. I'm lonely and scared and cold and miserable and captured, but I'm not hungry."
"Don't cry," said Tristram. "Look, I'll go into the village and get some food. You just wait here. The unicorn will protect you if anyone comes."
He reached up and gently lifted her down from the unicorn's back. The unicorn shook its mane and began to crop the grass of the meadow contentedly. The star sniffed.
"Wait here?"
she asked, holding up the chain that joined them.
"Oh," said Tristram, "give me your hand."
She reached her hand out to him. He fumbled with the chain to undo it, but it would not undo. Said Tristram. He tugged at the chain around his own wrist, but it, too, held fast.
"Oh, it looks," he said, "as if I'm as tied to you as you are to me."
The star threw her hair back, closed her eyes, and sighed deeply. And then, opening her eyes, once again self-possessed, she said,
"Perhaps there's a magic word or something."
"I don't know any magic words," said Tristram.
He held the chain up. It glittered red and purple in the light of the setting sun.
"Please?" he said.
There was a ripple in the fabric of the chain, and he slid his hand out of it.
Here you go, he said, passing the star the other end of the chain that had bound her. I'll try not to be too long. And if any of the fair folk sing their silly songs at you, for heaven's sake, don't throw your crutch at them. They'll only steal it.
I won't, she said.
I'll have to trust you, on your honour as a star, not to run away, he said. She touched her splintered leg. I will do no running for quite some time, she said pointedly. And with that, Tristan had to content himself. He walked the last half a mile into the village. It had no inn, being far off the beaten track for travellers. But the portly old woman who explained this to him then insisted he accompany her to her cottage, where she pressed upon him a wooden bowl full of barley porridge with carrots in it and a mug of small beer. He exchanged his cambric handkerchief for a bottle of elderflower cordial, a round of green cheese, and a number of unfamiliar fruits. They were soft and fuzzy, like apricots, but with a purple blue of grapes, and they smelled a little like ripe pears. Also, the woman gave him a small bale of hay for the unicorn. He walked back to the meadow where he had left them, munching on a piece of the fruit, which was juicy and chewy and quite sweet. He wondered if the star would like to try one, whether she'd like it if she did. He hoped that she would be pleased with what he brought her. At first, Tristan thought that he must have made a mistake and that he had lost his way in the moonlight. No, that was the same oak tree, the one beneath which the star had been sitting. Hello, he called. Glowworms and fireflies glittered green and yellow in the hedgerows and in the branches of trees. There came no reply, and Tristan felt a sick, stupid feeling in the pit of his stomach. Hello, he called. He stopped calling then, because there was no one to answer. He dropped the bale of hay, and then he kicked it. She was to the southwest of him, moving faster than he could walk. He followed after her in the bright moonlight. Inside, he felt numbed and foolish, stung by a pang of guilt and shame and regret. He should not have loosed her chain. He should have tied it to a tree. He should have forced the star to go with him into the village. This went through his head as he walked. But another voice spoke to him also, pointing out that if he had not unchained her then, he would have done it sometime soon, and she would have run from him then. He wondered if he would ever see the star again, and he stumbled over roots as the way led him between old trees into the deep woods. The moonlight slowly vanished beneath the thick canopy of leaves, and after stumbling vainly in the dark for a short while, he laid himself down beneath a tree, rested his head on his bag, and closed his eyes and felt sorry for himself until he fell asleep. On a rocky mountain pass, on the southernmost slopes of Mount Belly, the Witch Queen reined in her goat-drawn chariot and stopped and sniffed the chilly air. The myriad stars hung cold in the sky above her. Her red lips curved up into a smile of such beauty, such brilliance, such pure and perfect happiness that it would have frozen your blood in your veins to have seen it. There, she said, she is coming to me. And the wind of the mountain pass howled about her triumphantly, as if in answer. Primus sat beside the embers of his fire, and he shivered beneath his thick black robe. One of the black stallions, waking or dreaming, whinnied and snorted, and then rested once more. Primus's face felt strangely cold. He missed his thick beard. With a stick, he pushed a clay ball from the embers. He spat on his hands, then he split open the hot clay and smelled the sweet flesh of the hedgehog, which had cooked slowly in the embers as he had slept. He ate his breakfast meticulously, spitting the tiny bones into the fire circle once he'd chewed the meat from them. He washed the hedgehog down with a lump of hard cheese and a slightly vinegary white wine. Once he had eaten, he wiped his hands upon his robe, and then he cast the runes to find the topaz stone which conferred the lordship of the crag towns and the vast estates of the Stormhold. He cast them, then he stared, puzzled, at the small, square, red granite tiles. He picked them up once more, shook them in his long-fingered hands, dropped them onto the ground and stared at them again. Then Primus spat into the embers, which hissed lazily. He swept the tiles up and dropped them into the pouch at his belt.
It is moving faster, further, said Primus to himself. He pissed on the embers of the fire, for he was in wild country, and there were bandits and hobgoblins and worse in those lands, and he had no desire to alert them to his presence. Then he hitched the horses to the carriage and climbed into the driver's seat and drove them toward the forest, to the west, and to the mountain range beyond. The girl held tight to the unicorn's neck as it tumbled headlong through the dark forest. There was no moonlight between the trees, but the unicorn glimmered and shone with pale light like the moon, while the girl herself glittered and glowed as if she trailed a dust of lights. And as she passed through the trees, it might have appeared to a distant observer that she seemed to twinkle on and off and off and on like a tiny star. Chapter 6. What the Tree Said. Tristram Thorne was dreaming. He was in an apple tree, staring through a window at Victoria Forrester, who was getting undressed. As she removed her dress, revealing a healthy expanse of petticoat, Tristram felt the branch begin to give way beneath his feet, and then he was tumbling down through the air in the moonlight. He was falling into the moon, and the moon was talking to him. "Please," whispered the moon, in a voice that reminded him a little of his mother's. "Protect her. Protect my child. They mean her harm. I have done all I can." And the moon would have told him more, and perhaps she did. But the moon became the glimmer of moonlight on water far below him, and then he became aware of a small spider walking across his face, and of a crick in his neck, and he raised a hand and brushed the spider carefully from his cheek, and the morning sun was in his eyes, and the world was gold and green.
"You were dreaming,"
said a young woman's voice from somewhere above him. The voice was gentle and oddly accented. He could hear leaves rustle in the copper beech tree overhead. "Yes," he said to whoever was in the tree. "I was dreaming."
"I had a dream last night, too," said the voice. "In my dream, I looked up and I could see the whole forest and something huge was moving through it. And it got closer and closer and I knew what it was."
She stopped talking abruptly. "What was it?" asked Tristram.
"Everything," she said. "It was Pan. When I was very young, somebody, maybe it was a squirrel, they talk so much, or a magpie, or maybe a fishy, told me that Pan owned all this forest. Well, not owned, not like he would sell the forest to someone else or put a wall all around it."
"Or cut down the trees," said Tristram helpfully. There was a silence. He wondered where the girl had gone. "Hello?" he said. "Hello?" There was another rustle of leaves from above him.
"You shouldn't say things like that," she said.
"Sorry," said Tristram, not entirely sure what he was apologizing for.
"But you were telling me that Pan owned the forest."
"Of course he does," said the voice. "It's not hard to own something, or everything. You just have to know that it's yours, and then be willing to let it go. Pan owns this forest, like that. And in my dream, he came over to me. You were in my dream, too, leading a sad girl by a chain."
"She was a very sad, sad girl. Pan told me to help you."
"Me?" "And it made me feel all warm and tingly and squishy inside, from the tips of my leaves to the end of my roots. So I woke up, and there you were, fast asleep, with your head by my trunk, snoring like a pigwiggin."
Tristram scratched his nose. He stopped looking for a woman in the branches of the copper beech tree above him, and looked instead at the tree itself.
"You are a tree," said Tristram, putting his thoughts into words. "I didn't always used to be a tree," said the voice in the rustling of the copper beech leaves. "A magician made me a tree."
"What were you before?" asked Tristram.
"Do you think he likes me?"
"Who?"
"Pan. If you were the Lord of the Forest, you wouldn't give a job to someone, tell them to give all possible aid and succor, unless you liked them, would you?"
"Well," said Tristram. But before he had decided on the politic answer, the tree had already said,
"A nymph. I was a wood nymph, but I got pursued by a prince, not a nice prince, the other kind. And, well, you'd think a prince, even the wrong kind, would understand about boundaries, wouldn't you?"
You would?
Exactly what I think. But he didn't, so I did a bit of invoking while I was running, and ba-boom! Tree.
What do you think?
Well, said Tristram, I do not know what you were like as a wood nymph, madam, but you are a magnificent tree.
The tree made no immediate reply, but her leaves rustled prettily.
I was pretty cute as a nymph, too, she admitted coyly.
What kind of aid and succor exactly? Asked Tristram. Not that I'm grumbling. I mean, right now I need all the aid and succor I can get. But a tree is not necessarily the obvious place to look for it. You cannot come with me, or feed me, or bring the star here, or send us back to Wall to see my true love. I'm certain you would do a remarkable job of keeping off the rain, were it to rain, but it is not at present raining.
The tree rustled.
Why don't you tell me your story so far, said the tree, and let me be the best judge of whether or not I can be of help.
Tristram began to protest. He could feel the star moving further and further away from him at the speed of a cantering unicorn, and if there was one thing he did not have time for, it was the recitation of the adventures of his life to date. But then it occurred to him that any progress he had made on his quest so far he had made by accepting the help that had been offered to him. So he sat on the woodland floor, and he told the copper beech everything he could think of, about his love, pure and true, for Victoria Forrester, his promise to bring her a fallen star, not any fallen star, but the one they had seen together on the top of Dighty's Hill, and of his journey into Faerie. He told the tree of his journeyings, of the little hairy man, and of the small fair folk who stole his bowler hat. He told her of the magic candle, and his walk across the leagues to the star's side in the glade, and of the lion and the unicorn, and of how he had lost the star. He finished his story, and there was silence. The copper leaves on the tree shivered softly, as if in a gentle wind, and then harder, as if a storm were coming. And then the leaves formed a fierce, low voice which said, "If you had kept her chained, and she had escaped her chains, then there is no power on earth or sky could ever make me help you. Not if Great Pan or Lady Sylvia herself were to plead or implore me. But you unchained her, and for that I will help you."
"Thank you," said Tristram. "I will tell you three true things. Two of them I will tell you now, and the last is for when you need it most. You'll have to judge for yourself when that will be. First, the star is in great danger. What occurs in the midst of a wood is soon known at its furthest borders, and the trees talk to the wind, and the wind passes the word along to the next wood it comes to. There are forces that mean her harm, and worse than harm. You must find her and protect her. Secondly, there is a path through the forest off past that fir tree, and I could tell you things about that fir tree that would make a boulder blush. And in a few minutes, a carriage will be coming down that path. Hurry, and you will not miss it. And thirdly, hold out your hands." Tristram held out his hands. From high above him, a copper-coloured leaf came falling slowly, spinning and gliding and tumbling down. It landed neatly in the palm of his right hand. "There," said the tree. "Keep it safe, and listen to it when you need it most. Now," she told him, "the coach is nearly here. Run, run!" Tristram picked up his bag and he ran, fumbling the leaf into the pocket of his tunic as he did so. He could hear hoofbeats through the glade, coming closer and closer. He knew that he could not reach it in time, despaired of reaching it, but still he ran faster, until all he could hear was his heart pounding in his chest and his ears, and the hiss of air as he pulled it into his lungs. He scrambled and dashed through the bracken and made it to the path as the carriage came down the track. It was a black coach, drawn by four night-black horses, driven by a pale fellow in a long black robe. It was 20 paces from Tristram. He stood there, gulping breath, and then he tried to call out, but his throat was dry, and his wind was gone, and his voice came from him in a dry sort of croaking whisper. He tried to shout, and simply wheezed. The carriage passed him by without slowing. Tristram sat on the ground and caught his breath. Then, afraid for the star, he got back to his feet and walked, as fast as he could manage, along the forest path. He had not walked for more than 10 minutes when he came upon the black coach. A huge branch, itself as big as some trees, had fallen from an oak tree onto the path directly in front of the horses, and the driver, who was also the coach's sole occupant, was endeavouring to lift it out of the way.
"Damnedest thing," said the coachman,
who wore a long black robe, and who Tristan estimated to be in his late 40s.
"There was no wind, no storm. It simply fell. Terrified the horses."
His voice was deep and booming. Tristan and the driver unhitched the horses and roped them to the oak branch. And the two men pushed, and the four horses pulled, and together they dragged the branch to the side of the track. Tristan said a silent thank you to the oak tree, whose branch had fallen, to the copper beech and to Pan of the forests, and then he asked the driver if he would give him a ride through the forest.
"I do not take passengers," said the driver,
rubbing his bearded chin.
"Of course," said Tristan, "but without me, you would still be stuck here. Surely Providence sent you to me, just as Providence sent me to you. I will not take you out of your path, and there may again come a time when you're glad of another pair of hands."
The coach driver looked Tristan over, from his head to his feet. Then he reached into the velvet bag that hung from his belt and removed a handful of square red granite tiles.
"Pick one," he said to Tristan.
Tristan picked a stone tile and showed the symbol carved upon it to the man.
Was all the driver said. "Now pick another."
Tristan did so.
"And another."
The man rubbed his chin once more.
"Yes, you can come with me," he said. "The runes seem certain of that, although there will be danger. But perhaps there will be more fallen branches to move. You can sit up front if you wish, on the driver's seat beside me, and keep me company."
"It was a peculiar thing," observed Tristram, as he climbed up into the driver's seat. But the first time he had glanced into the interior of the coach, he had fancied that he saw 5 pale gentlemen, all in grey, staring sadly out at him. But the next time he had looked inside, nobody had been there at all. The carriage rattled and pounded over the grassy track beneath a golden-green canopy of leaves. Tristan worried about the star. She might be ill-tempered, he thought, but it was with a certain amount of justification, after all. He hoped that she could stay out of trouble until he caught up with her. It was sometimes said that the grey and black mountain range, which ran like a spine north to south down that part of Faerie, had once been a giant who grew so huge and so heavy that one day, worn out from the sheer effort of moving and living, he had stretched out on the plain and fallen into a sleep so profound that centuries passed between heartbeats. This would have been a long time ago, if it ever happened, in the first age of the world, when all was stone and fire, water and wind, and there were few left alive to put the lie to it if it was not true. Still, true or not, they called the 4 great mountains of the range Mount Head, Mount Shoulder, Mount Belly, and Mount Knees. And the foothills to the south were known as the Feet. There were passes through the mountains, one between the head and the shoulders, where the neck would have been, and one immediately to the south of Mount Belly. They were wild mountains, inhabited by wild creatures. Slate-coloured trolls, hairy wild men, strayed wadwos, mountain goats and mining gnomes, hermits and exiles, and the occasional peak witch. This was not one of the really high mountain ranges of Faerie, such as Mount Huon, on the top of which is the Stormhold, but it was a hard range for lone travellers to cross, nonetheless. The Witch Queen had crossed the pass south of Mount Belly in a couple of days, and now waited at the opening of the pass. Her goats were tethered to a thorn bush, which they chewed without enthusiasm. She sat on the side of the unhitched chariot and sharpened her knives with a whetstone. The knives were old things. The hilts were made of bone, while the blades were chipped volcanic glass, black as jet, with white snowflake shapes frozen forever into the obsidian. There were 2 knives. The smaller, a hatchet-bladed cleaver, heavy and hard for cutting through the ribcage, for jointing and segmenting. The other, a long, dagger-like blade for cutting out the heart. when the knives were so sharp that you could have drawn either blade across your throat, and you would never have felt more than the touch of the lightest hair as the spreading warmth of your life's blood made a quiet escape. The Witch Queen put them away and commenced her preparations. She walked over to the goats and whispered a word of power to each of them. Where the goats had been stood a man with a white chin beard and a boyish, dull-eyed young woman. They said nothing. She crouched beside her chariot and whispered several words to it. The chariot did nothing, and the witch woman stamped her foot on the rock. "I'm getting old," she said to her two servants. They said nothing in reply, gave no indication that they even understood her. Things inanimate have always been more difficult to change than things animate. Their souls are older and stupider and harder to persuade. If I but had my true youth again, why, in the dawn of the world, I could transform mountains into seas and clouds into palaces. I could populate cities with the pebbles on the shingle if I were young again. She sighed and raised a hand. A blue flame flickered about her fingers for a moment, and then, as she lowered her hand and bent down to touch her chariot, the fire vanished. She stood up straight. There were streaks of grey now in her raven-black hair, and dark pouches beneath her eyes, but the chariot was gone, and she stood in front of a small inn at the edge of the mountain pass. Far away the thunder rumbled quietly, and lightning flickered in the distance. The inn sign swung and creaked in the wind. There was a picture of a chariot painted upon it. "You two," said the witch woman, "inside. She's riding this way, and she will have to come through this pass. Now, I simply have to ensure that she will come inside." "You," she said to the man with a white chin beard, "are Billy, the owner of this tavern. I shall be your wife, and this," pointing to the dull-eyed girl, who had once been Brevis, "is our daughter, the pot maid." Another crash of thunder echoed down from the mountain peaks louder than before. "It will rain soon," said the witch woman. "Let us prepare the fire." Tristan could feel the star ahead of them, moving steadily onward. He felt as if he were gaining ground upon her. And to his relief, the black carriage continued to follow the star's path. Once, when the road diverged, Tristan was concerned that they might take the wrong fork. He was ready to leave the coach and travel on alone, if that should happen. His companion reined in the horses, clambered down from the driver's seat, and took out his runes. Then, his consultation complete, he climbed back up and took the carriage down the left-hand fork. "If it is not too forward of me to inquire," said Tristan, "might I ask what it is that you are in search of?"
"My destiny," said the man, after a short pause. "My right to rule. And you?"
"There's a young lady that I have offended with my behaviour," said Tristan. "I wish to make amends." As he said it, he knew it to be true. The driver grunted. The forest canopy was thinning rapidly. Trees became sparser, and Tristan stared up at the mountains in front of them, and he gasped.
"Such mountains," he said.
"When you are older," said his companion, "you must visit my citadel, high on the crags of Mount Huon. Now that is a mountain, and from there we can look down upon mountains next to which these," and he gestured toward the heights of Mount Belly ahead of them, "are the merest foothills."
"Truth to tell," said Tristan,
"I hope to spend the rest of my life as a sheep farmer in the village of Wall, for I have now had as much excitement as any man could rightly need, what with candles and trees and the young lady and the unicorn. But I take the invitation in the spirit in which it was given, and thank you for it. If ever you visit Wall, then you must come to my house, and I shall give you woolen clothes and sheep cheese and all the mutton stew you can eat."
"You are far too kind," said the driver. The path was easier now, made of crushed gravel and graded rocks, and he cracked his whip to urge the four black stallions on faster.
"You saw a unicorn, you say?"
Tristan was about to tell his companion all about the encounter with the unicorn, but he thought better of it, and simply said, "He was a most noble beast."
"The unicorns are the moon's creatures," said the driver. "I have never seen one, but it is said that they serve the moon and do her bidding. We shall reach the mountains by tomorrow evening.
I shall call a halt at sunset tonight. If you wish, you may sleep inside the coach. I myself shall sleep beside the fire. There was no change in his tone of voice, but Tristram knew, with a certainty that was both sudden and shocking in its intensity, that the man was scared of something, frightened to the depths of his soul. Lightning flickered on the mountaintops that night. Tristram slept on the leather seat of the coach, his head on a sack of oats. He dreamed of ghosts and of the moon and stars. The rain began at dawn, abruptly, as if the sky had turned to water. Low grey clouds hid the mountains from sight. In the driving rain, Tristram and the coach driver hitched the horses to the carriage and set off. It was all uphill now, and the horses went no faster than a walk.
"You could go inside," said the driver. "No point in us both getting wet."
They put on one-piece oilskins they had found beneath the driver's seat. "It would be hard for me to be wetter," said Tristram, "without my first leaping into a river. I shall stay here. Two pairs of eyes and two pairs of hands may well be the saving of us." His companion grunted. He wiped the rain from his eyes and mouth with a cold, wet hand. And then he said,
"You're a fool, boy, but I appreciate it."
He transferred the reins to his left hand and extended his right hand.
"I am known as Primus, the Lord Primus."
"Tristram. Tristram Thorne," he said, feeling that the man had somehow earned the right to know his true name. They shook hands. The rain fell harder. The horses slowed to the slowest walk as the path became a stream, and the heavy rain cut off all vision as effectively as the thickest fog.
"There is a man," said the Lord Primus, shouting to be heard now over the rain, the wind whipping the words from his lips. "He's tall, looks a little like me, but thinner, more crow-like. His eyes seem innocent and dull, but there is death in them. He is called Septimus, for he was the seventh boy-child our father spawned. If ever you see him, run and hide. His business is with me, but he will not hesitate to kill you if you stand in his way, or perhaps to make you his instrument with which to kill me."
A wild gust of wind drove a tankardful of rainwater down Tristram's neck.
"He sounds a most dangerous man," said Tristram. "He is the most dangerous man you will ever meet."
Tristram peered silently into the rain and the gathering darkness. It was becoming harder to see the road. Primus spoke again, saying,
"If you ask me, there is something unnatural about this storm."
"Unnatural?"
"Or more than natural. Supernatural, if you will. I hope there is an inn along the way. The horses need a rest, and I could do with a dry bed and a warm fire and a good meal."
Tristram shouted his agreement. They sat together, getting wetter. Tristram thought about the star and the unicorn. She would be cold by now and wet. He worried about her broken leg and thought about how saddle sore she must be. It was all his fault. He felt wretched.
"I am the most miserable person who ever lived," he said to the Lord Primus when they stopped to feed the horses feed bags of damp oats.
"You are young and in love," said Primus. "Every young man in your position is the most miserable young man who ever lived."
Tristram wondered how Lord Primus could have divined the existence of Victoria Forrester. He imagined himself recounting his adventures to her, back at Wall in front of a blazing parlour fire. But somehow all of his tales seemed a little flat. Dusk seemed to have started at dawn that day, and now the sky was almost black. Their path continued to climb. The rain would let up for moments and then redouble, falling harder than ever.
"Is that a light over there?" asked Tristram.
"I cannot see anything. Maybe it was fool's fire or lightning," said Primus,
and then they gained a bend in the road, and he said,
"I was wrong. That is a light. Well spotted, young'un. But there are bad things in these mountains. We must only hope that they are friendly."
The horses put on a fresh burst of speed now that their destination was in sight. A flash of lightning revealed the mountains rising steeply up on either side of them.
"We're in luck," said Primus, his bass voice booming like thunder. "It's an inn!"
Chapter 7. At the Sign of the Chariot. The star had been soaked to the skin when she arrived at the pass, sad and shivering. She was worried about the unicorn. They had found no food.